Okay, well, here we are. We're in the beginning, and God created the universe. We just take that by faith. And he started with formless and void, that's chaos and emptiness, and he took that and he formed it and he filled it in 6 24-hour days. And then what he did then was he took a man, called him Adam, made him king over his creation and also servant under him in his garden. Now we're still in Genesis 2 through 4, and Genesis 2 through 4 is where Moses tells us the history of God's creation. Chapter 2, verse 4, it says that these are the generations, or this is the account of the heavens and the earth when they were created in the day that the Lord God made earth and heaven. So this is Moses kind of giving us a story, the book of births, because that's what the word account and Genesis and generations means, birth or beginnings. And in chapter 2 through 4, we see Adam, Eve, the serpent, the fall, Cain, and Abel. And this history is given by Moses to explain us. It does not explain anything biologically or scientifically. You know, there's many questions in this realm. And if you have questions about scientifically or biologically, I encourage you to look at books like Henry Morris, John Whitcomb, The Genesis Flood, The Early Earth, and then go to Creation Science Research and listen to Ken Ham. He answers a lot of the questions that we raise and that unbelievers raise about the book for us. And we're going to go right into chapter 4, verse 1, and we're going to read about this. The man had relations with his wife Eve, and she conceived and gave birth to Cain. And she said, I have gotten a man-child with the help of the Lord. Now, Cain means, I have gotten a man-child. I have acquired, like a possession, this son. Now, Cain is a heavy, guttural word. In Hebrew, you would say, Cain. And Eve is saying, I have the man. I have my man that the Lord promised. And she's thinking back to Genesis 3:15 when the Lord brought judgment upon them. Now, her next son, in 4:2, it says, and again she gave birth to his brother. Cain has a brother now, Abel. And Abel was a keeper of flocks, but Cain was a tiller of the ground. Now, Abel is the next son, but notice how Abel is called first, not Abel. He's called first his brother. So where's the emphasis? It's on Cain. Now, Abel means breath or vapor, and it's a light, airy kind of word. It doesn't have that heaviness, that gravitas that Chaim has. Abel is Hevel. Who do you think he favors? And Moses tells us that Abel's a shepherd. He raises sheep, which provide clothing, but Cain is a farmer. He is struggling with the curse of the soil to provide food. Cain is the first one to bring an offering to the Lord. Look at verse 3. So it came about in the course of time that Cain brought an offering to the Lord of the fruit of the ground. Now, it doesn't seem like there's any problem so far. You have Cain, you have Abel. Cain brings a sacrifice. Cain, like the Lord had told Adam he would do, Cain is working and toiling by the sweat of his brow to provide food. Now, the conflict doesn't begin till the next sentence. Look at 4:4-5. And Abel, on his part, also brought of the firstlings of his flock and of their fat portions, and the Lord had regard for Abel and for his offering. But for Cain and for his offering, he had no regard. He just kind of looked away. So Cain became very angry, and his countenance fell. There's no indication in this text why the Lord rejects Cain and not Abel. It's not there. Moses doesn't tell us. Moses tells us very clearly that Cain is angry. His face falls away from God. I'm not looking at God. And I'm sure he turns from Abel as well. And there's all kinds of hints of alienation here that Moses has given us. They offer separately. And, you know, we just studied something in a study, Philippians and Colossians, and we should have learned something important there. What did Philippians and Colossians tell us? How should believers interact with each other? Isolation? Do our own thing? No, what? It's partnership, koinonia. And then if we have a disagreement or a complaint against someone, what should we do about it? Hold it against them? Forgiveness. That's not happening here. Notice how the Lord goes to Cain just as he did to Adam before. There's no accusation. You'll read no accusation in 4:6. Look at this. The Lord said to Cain, why are you angry? That's an honest question, because he can see he's angry. Why are you angry, and why has your countenance fallen? Why has your face fallen? Why won't you look at me? This is grace. He's questioning Cain. But, you know, even before Cain can answer those first two questions, the Lord goes on and he gives him a way out. Look at 7. If you do well, will not your countenance, will not your face be lifted up? And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door and its desire is for you, but you must master it. So even before Cain can answer, the Lord gives a solution. Now let's take the question the Lord asks. If you do well, will not your face be lifted up? Let's make that, instead of a question, let's make that an active statement. Because see, you notice verse 7, this will not your countenance be lifted up is a passive voice. That's hard for us to understand. It's easier for us to understand an active voice sentence where there's a subject and a verb. And let's turn it around and say, the Lord's saying really this, and put it in a statement. If you do the right thing, I will lift you up and I will accept you. I will turn your face toward me. If you'll do the right thing, I will accept you. And that's grace. That's grace. Because the problem is not with God. The problem's with Cain. He's turned his face from God. So what's the right thing to do? I think it's real simple. I think it's give up your anger because of what he says next. Give up your anger. Give up your grudge. And remember how I talked about a grudge, how it starts off real cute and seems kind of harmless? What it grows into? But you know, go to Abel. Go to Abel and reconcile whatever problem you have. Now the Lord gives a warning. You're in danger. Sin, which is his anger, is crouching like a beast at the door. And it's waiting for an opportunity to leap. And sin's desire is to control you, to master you. But you must master it. See, the lesson here is that he can't do this alone. He needs first the Lord. And God's given him the perfect opportunity. And he needs Abel. They need each other. They don't see that. Or Cain doesn't see that. But you must master your anger. You can recover from this. If you do the right thing, you can recover. But you must make the decision. And what's in Cain's mind? What's at the door of Cain's heart? Which way will he go? That's the question. If you were reading this slowly enough, that would be the question in your mind. What's he going to do? Now, Cain does act, and he acts very swiftly. Look at verse 8. And Cain told Abel his brother, and it came about when they were in the field. Cain rose up against Abel his brother and killed him. Very quick. Very quick decision. I like the NIV and the RSV, the way it says it here. Cain said to his brother, hey, let's go out into the field. Let's go out in the field. He killed him there, out of sight. In that verse, in verse 8, his brother is emphasized twice. So the Lord comes again to Cain. And again, you'll see no accusation here. I think this is amazing. 4, 9, and 10. The Lord then said to Cain, where's your brother Abel? Abel, your brother. And he said, I do not know. And then he goes, am I my brother's keeper? Meaning, am I his protector? Am I supposed to be watching over him? And the Hebrew question is framed in such a way, he's saying, if he were to say it in a statement, I'm not his keeper, I'm not his protector. Why are you asking me? It's a very kind of an arrogant response back to God. And God says, he says, what have you done? The voice of your brother's blood is crying to me from the ground. You may not be willing to tell me what you've done, but Abel is telling me what you've done because his blood cries from the ground. Cain's heart is hard. He's unrepentant. He lies. And at this point, everything now is up to Cain. Look at 11 and 12. And now you are cursed. Notice before it's just the ground is cursed, but now he says, and now you are cursed from the ground, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. And when you cultivate the ground, it shall no longer yield its strength to you. You shall be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth. God's saying, no matter how hard you work, Cain, you're not going to get a crop. This is the most significant punishment there can possibly be for a farmer. No crop. So how's Cain respond? Look at 13 and 14. Cain said to the Lord, my punishment is too great to bear. This is too much. I'm a farmer. I got to make crops. Behold, thou hast driven me this day from the face of the ground, and from thy face I shall be hidden. And I shall be a vagrant and a wanderer on the earth. And it will come about that whoever finds me will kill me. Cain objects to this punishment. Notice he has no regret for the sin. He is remorseful, but he's not repentant. You know what he's sorry about? He feels fearful that he's going to suffer the same fate that he dealt to his brother. He's not sorry his brother's dead. Not at all. He doesn't even consider the harshness and the cruelty of what he has done. He's only considering how hard it's going to be for him. This is how hard he is. And this is God coming and speaking to him graciously, kindly, and really offering him a way out. Because I still don't think at this point it's too late for him until he goes away. God still makes him a promise. Look at 15. He says, "So the Lord said to him, therefore, whoever kills Cain, vengeance will be taken on him sevenfold. And the Lord appointed a sign for Cain, lest anyone finding him should slay him." So there's grace there because the Lord promises to protect him physically. He's not going to be murdered, but he will be marked. Now, I don't know what this mark is, but it's very clearly that it serves to protect Cain from murder. The Lord did something that protected him from being murdered, and it became evident to others of his banishment. This man has been banished because he sinned. But don't you dare lay a hand on him. So he's protecting him. Now Cain is simply a drifter. That's what the word vagabond means, a bum. But you know what? Cain goes on to prosper. He doesn't prosper as a farmer, but he does prosper. He doesn't prosper in the fields, but a new thing, a new element comes into Genesis. A city, that's new. And from now on in Genesis, a city will be associated mainly with rebellion and evil. And it's a place where rebels unite themselves in defiance against God. Look at 16 and 17. "Then Cain went out from the presence of the Lord, and he settled in the land of Nod," which is interesting, that's a play on word vagrant. It settles in the land of the vagrants, "east of Eden. And Cain had relations with his wife, and she conceived and gave birth to Enoch. And then Cain built a city, and he called the name of the city Enoch, after the name of his son." So he built a city and names it Enoch because he dedicates the city to Enoch. Now, Enoch means dedicated. Now, the question comes up here, and people raise this question, who did Cain marry? There's only, so far, only like four people in the whole story. And one of them's dead already. So who does he marry? Let's just go to God's word directly, and we'll find out. Look at Genesis 5, 3 through 5, because it gives a very simple answer. It says, in verse 3, "When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness, according to his image, and named him Seth." Now, he's 130 years old. "Then the days of Adam, after he became the father of Seth, were 800 years, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died." Adam was 130 when he had Seth. Now, he lived another 800 after that, but just take the 130 years, and you do the math. Go home and do the math. You can easily have 10 kids in 20 years. No problem. My mother had 7 kids in 12 years. And these people are healthy and vigorous. Adam could easily have had 120 kids by the time Seth was born. And they all have kids. And we don't know where in there Cain was born. Just think of the numbers of people that can come forward from 120 kids. Those of you who have grandchildren, great-grandchildren, just maybe with 3 or 4, notice how that multiplies over the years. So I'll just leave it at that. Now, it doesn't dwell much on Cain's many, many children, but it does dwell on another very infamous son, Lamech, and that's in 18. "Now, Enoch was born to Arad, and to Arad became the father of this other guy, Mehujael, and to him became the father of Methushael, and then to him he became the father of Lamech." Now, this is the one that's going to be focused upon. "And Lamech took himself 2 wives. The name of one was Adah, the name of the other was Zillah, and Adah gave birth to Jabal, and he was the father of those who dwell in tents and have livestock. And his brother's name was Jubal, and he was the father of all those who played the lyre and the pipe. And for Zillah, she gave birth to Tubal-Cain, the forger of implements of bronze and iron. And the sister of Tubal-Cain was Naamah." Now for Moses, all these people are important, but he wants to focus on Lamech in verse 23. "Lamech said to his wives, Ada and Zillah." Notice, he's got 2 wives. He's polygamous in defiance of God's plan, in defiance of God's intent. In 2:24, "The husband will leave his father and mother and cleave unto his wife, and the two shall become one." So if two become one in a marriage, how can you bring in another person? It doesn't say three will become one. It doesn't say the man will leave his father and mother and find 2 women and cleave to them both. God's intent was 1 woman. Under Lamech, it's not completely negative. Notice this. There's a development of culture, music, agriculture, bronze implements, tools, and weapons. And I want you to notice one thing. The picture of Cain and Abel on the screen, you may think, well, these look like cavemen, right? What we would call Neanderthals or knuckle-dragging rednecks, whatever. Relatively ignorant people. But, you know, you see here from this rapid development of culture, these are actually very intelligent and capable people. They may not be dressed in three-piece suits because they wouldn't have had three-piece suits, but they are dressed in the way that God had told them they must dress, with skins of animals. But, you know, in spite of the fact they're able to improve the world, the wilderness that they're in, with some technological advances and with some music to give them joy and, you know, music soothes the heart of the savage beast, you know that. The downward depravity of man continues. And that's when we come to 23 after Lamech says to his two wives, "Listen to my voice, you wives of Lamech. Give heed to my speech, for I have killed a man for wounding me, and I've killed a boy for striking me. If Cain is avenged sevenfold, then Lamech 77-fold. He brags that he's a murderer of two persons. One's just a little boy. And he boasts that the vengeance upon him is 70 times greater than Cain's. I'm that much more wicked than Cain. You know, if he's goading the Lord into a fight, can you think of a greater folly than that? And you know, the Lord hears him, but he doesn't come to him. And he doesn't say to him, why are you like this? He gets no chance. He is so hardened and so confirmed in his unbelief and rebellion toward God. God doesn't even come and question him like he did with Adam and Cain. There's this bright spot in the midst of this kind of depravity and rebellion. There's a Seth. Look at 25 and 26. And Adam had relations with his wife again, and she gave birth to a son and named him Seth. Notice, she names him. And she says, God has appointed me another offspring in the place of Abel, for Cain killed him. And to Seth, to him a son was born, and he called his name Enosh. And then men began to call upon the name of the Lord. Notice the change, this bright spot. No longer is it the Lord coming down and saying to men, what's the problem? Why don't you turn to me? Now it's men calling on God. Lord, you come down and be with us. This is the great bright spot. And Seth means set. Seth means to set. And notice what she says. He's been set in place of or in exchange for Abel. And it's a good exchange because of this fact that men begin to call upon the name of the Lord. And this calling upon the name of the Lord is the first time that this expression is used in Genesis. The first time you find this in the Bible. This is a public proclamation of the Lord. This is what the intent of this means. Claim of worship for him. And it's also a claim of dependence upon him. This is what they're saying to the culture around them. This is what faith is. Now we come to chapter 5. Did anybody read this week? Do you find it kind of boring and repetitive as you read through it? Even depressing, isn't it? Now there's a certain way to read this, but what this is in chapter 5, this is a new story. It's a new history. Verse 1, this is the book of the generations of Adam. That's the same thing he said in 2:4. This is the book of the generations of the heavens and the earth. This is Adam's history, the history of Adam's family or the history of Adam's line. Basically focuses on one man, Adam, and his line through the replacement son, Seth. It links Adam with Noah. It tells us how also that everybody dies, just as God had promised. We're all going the same direction. We're all going toward the same cliff. Now here's the story of Adam's line, 5:1 through 5. We've already read the majority of these verses, but let's go through them and look at them again. This is the book of the generations of Adam. In the day when God created man, he made him in the likeness of God. He created them male and female, and he blessed them and named them man in the day that they were created. Notice he's doing a little rehash of Genesis 1. But now he's going to move on. When Adam had lived 130 years, he became the father of a son in his own likeness according to his image. His name was Seth. And the days of Adam after he became the father of Seth were 800 years, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days that Adam lived were 930 years, and he died, just as God had promised. In 5:9 it says about Enosh, who was Seth's son. In 11 it says, and he died. In 5:12 it talks about Kenan. And in 5:14 it says, and he died. And in 5:15 it talks about Mahalalel. And in 5:17 it says, then he died. And it goes on like that over and over and over until you get to Enoch in 5:21 and 22. And Enoch lived 65 years and became the father of Methuselah. Then Enoch walked with God 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah, and he had other sons and daughters. So all the days of Enoch, and it goes on, were 365 years. Now notice this. We already had an Enoch, didn't we? One of the sons of Cain. And the name means dedicated, right? Why did he call him dedicated? Because he named the city after him. He dedicated the city to him. But this Enoch is much different. His name still means dedicated, but is he worried about a city? No, he dedicates himself to the Lord, and he's the preacher of God's judgment. Now, it doesn't say that here. We have to go to Jude 14 and 15 to find out this background. But Jude 14, 15, these two verses, say that Enoch is seventh from Adam. He prophesied. He says this, "Behold, the Lord came with many thousands of his holy ones." Notice the verb tense in this. The Lord came. This is prophetic perfect. Enoch is looking as if the Lord has already brought judgment, as if it's already really happened. And all he's doing is preaching about it. You find this all the way through the Old Testament, the way the prophets would preach. They preach in ways of things about the future as if they've already taken place. Now look why he comes, to execute judgment and to convict all. All who? Ungodly. 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 Ungodly sinners who've spoken against him. This is what Enoch was doing while he was walking with God. Notice in verse 22, when it says they walked with God 300 years after he became the father of Methuselah. 300 years, so all the days of Enoch were 365 years total, and Enoch walked with God, and he was not. He was not what? For God took him. He doesn't die. He's so committed to the Lord's promise of judgment that he even names his own son Methuselah. It means when he dies, it will come. What will come? He knows judgment is coming. He doesn't know it's a flood. There's no such thing as a flood up to this point. But we know what he doesn't know. And he walked with God and God took him. He's the first man in this entire line that doesn't die. He's an exception. That he doesn't die. Now, isn't this what the Lord intended for Adam and Eve? Didn't he create them to walk with him in the garden and to live the eternal life? He even gave them the tree of eternal life. He created man as a partner, and he created man to be like him. And it's so heartbreaking that Adam and Eve did not learn that thing on the day that they met the serpent. They followed him rather than the Lord. Now, verse 525 says that Methuselah lived 187 years and became the father of Lamech. That's another Lamech. We just had a Lamech. But this Lamech is so different from the Lamech of chapter 4. Remember, the Lamech of Cain's line is a braggart and a murderer. This Lamech's not a murderer. This Lamech is a life giver, because this Lamech gives birth to Noah. Look at 28:29. And Lamech lived 182 years and became the father of a son. Now he called his name Noah, saying, "This is one who shall give us rest from our work and from the toil of your hands arising from the ground which the Lord has cursed." When Lamech has Noah, he says Noah is going to give us hope. Noah is hope. Noah will give us rest from the curse. And Noah means rest. And Noah has three sons in 532. Noah was 500 years old, and Noah became the father of Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And their story is just beginning. Now, Moses is clear. In this chapter, he's pointing out that we can have life. Death is not the final victor. God's going to snatch some people away like he did Enoch. Some God is going to rescue like he rescued Noah. Men are going to go through serious and severe trials as believers, and God's going to rescue them. But no one who walks with God, whether they suffer physical death or not, will ever suffer spiritual death, because of what he did for Adam and Eve is the example that God clothed them, and they are clothed by his grace to live forever with him. Now in chapter 4, we saw the spread of sin. And the spread of sin goes through all of Adam's family. And we saw how sin affects people, the culture, society, through Lamech. And you have to remember, the Lord didn't curse man, he cursed the ground. But what the problem is man has fallen. When Adam fell from relationship with God, he did exactly what Cain did. He hid from God. He turned his face from God. And God came and questioned him. But God intervened, and Adam did allow God to restore him and Eve together. He clothed them with animal skins, and they're restored. See, what we live with in our world, out of Adam, every man who's ever born comes into the world a confirmed and committed enemy of God. We want nothing to do with God. No matter how religious you are, you really want nothing to do with God. Cain brings a curse on himself. See, the ground is cursed, but Cain brings a curse on himself. And his rebellion against God is certain. It's eternal. He will die an enemy of God, forever separated, which is really the death that God warned Adam and Eve about. You will be eternally separated from me. Now, in chapter 5, we see this. The certainty of death is this finality of the curse, that death is certain because of sin. Death is a penalty for sin, period. And yet, what do we find in chapter 5? There's an exception. There's an exception to that. Now, there's some conclusions that we can take. Why did God have regard for Abel's sacrifice and not Cain? Why is Cain so angry? It's because Abel had faith. And he'd gained a testimony that he was righteous. And the writer of Hebrews says that that still speaks to us. This is for us to learn. By faith, Abel offered a better sacrifice than Cain. And he obtained the testimony that he was righteous. That means holy, set apart. God said, you're now mine. And God testified about his gifts. God was talking about Abel. That probably rubbed Cain the wrong way. And through his faith, though he's dead, he still speaks. Abel's faith speaks to us. That's why I said Moses is here to teach us a history of us, because he's still speaking to us. Notice it says better sacrifice. That's a little word you don't want to overlook. Because does that mean better as opposed to evil? What do we say better is? Better is in between what? Good and best. So Abel didn't offer the best sacrifice. He offered something better than a good sacrifice. Now, if you're going to compare sacrifices, one that's good and one that's best, Abel's got a better sacrifice. Cain's sacrifice was not evil. Cain's sacrifice was good, but it wasn't as good as Abel's. Cain's problem is he hates, but he still offers a sacrifice. He took the toil of his work and he brought it to an altar, and he's the first one that talked about to bring the sacrifice. But Abel's is better. First, he's offering an animal. Something has to die in man's place in exchange for life. That's why Abel's is better. Who's the best sacrifice? In the book of Hebrews, he's always saying, this is good, this is better, this is best. Who's the best sacrifice? Jesus Christ. And the book of Hebrews is about comparing what is good in the Old Testament with what is the best in the New Testament. Now notice Enoch. The same words are said about Enoch that we find with Abel. Same ideas, I should say, rather than words. Because notice what it says about Enoch. It's by faith. Enoch was taken up. He didn't see death. This is very clearly the statement. He didn't see death. He was not found because God took him up. For he obtained the witness that before being taken up, he was pleasing to God. What are the parallels there? The parallels are between righteous and pleasing to God. They're the same thing. It's the same thing. If I'm righteous, I'm pleasing to God. And what Enoch does is walk in a way that's pleasing to God and speak in a way that's pleasing to God because he's righteous. And Abel does the right thing because he's righteous. And notice, Abel obtained a testimony. Enoch obtained the witness. Same word for testimony. Here we have two men of faith. One dies, the other lives. And both of these men are alive. They're alive today. They're in heaven. They're in glory today. They're watching this Bible study. Going, hey, they're talking about us. Look at it. Listen. But Abel has a relationship with God that Cain does not. Now, why do I say that? Because Cain has no fellowship with Abel. That's pretty clear in the text. There's no indication they cooperate at all. And I think Moses intends us to see that. And it reminds me, Cain and Abel remind me of the parable that Jesus told of the older brother and the prodigal son. Now, generally, we just call that the parable of the prodigal son. But it's the parable of the older brother and the prodigal son. And in Jesus' parable, he portrays animosity between the two brothers, but it's not apparent in the story until the end of the parable. Remember how in the prodigal story, the older brother resents the way the father says, let's have a party, my son was dead, but now he's alive? The older brother would just as soon see him die and never return. He's telling the story because the way the Pharisees see him and his followers, they want Jesus dead. They wish he would just go away, but they really want him dead. And I think Abel, ultimately, the reason it says in faith he offered a sacrifice, because I believe that what Adam taught him was what Adam learned from God, that there had to be a death of a living substitute to atone for sin, and Abel believed that. And so he offered his sacrifice in faith, but Cain didn't. Adam and Eve learned that fig leaves wouldn't cover their shame, but God covered their shame with animal skins. We see the same contrast with Cain and Abel. Cain brings fruit, vegetation. Abel brings the animal, and the animal is the better sacrifice. But the true motive behind Cain's anger is that he hates Abel. That's the motive. And Cain, hating Abel, hates God. And we know that for certain that this is true, because in 1 John it tells us this. John gives us a glimpse into Cain's mind that we do not get from Moses. John 3, we should love one another and not be like Cain, being of the evil one, who killed his brother. For what reason? Why did he do it? Because his deeds were evil and his brothers were righteous. Do not marvel, brethren, if the world hates you. And let's insert there, like Cain hated Abel. He who does not love abides in death. Everyone who hates his brother, did Cain hate his brother? Yes. How do we know? He murdered him. He's a murderer. Do you know that no murderer has eternal life? Now, even among believers, there's a danger against alienation from each other and from God. Whenever we sin, whenever we hold a grudge against someone, we are alienating ourselves from that person and from God. And so that's what Paul has in mind when he exhorts us what must be done. We must forgive. And that's what Colossians, I think this is the heart of Colossians, that's what must be done. To put on a heart of compassion, kindness, bearing with one another, putting up with people. Putting up with people who have the same kind of faults I have and forgiving each other. Whoever has a complaint against anyone, forgive them, just as the Lord forgave you. Reconciling and forgiving. And I think this is more than just an encouragement here. I think it's a subtle warning that if you drift away from this principle, you will be in alienation. You'll be in isolation. You'll become bitter. And you'll wish to see people fail. See, I'd like to see that guy be brought down a notch, because the Lord seems to be blessing him a little more than I think he deserves. And if we don't do this, we cannot live the life. That eternal life, that's not just length, but Jesus says that kind of life, we have living waters flowing up out of you. And they're flowing out of you, out to others. And so you're a blessing to others, not just yourself. Now next week, we're going to do Genesis 6 and 7, which talks about Noah and the flood. And this begins a long section, but we're going to move through this pretty quickly, because I think the lessons here for us are pretty clear. And we can pull out from a lot of detail some very clear lessons. I would encourage you to read ahead, because...